When people ask, I tell them I met Dana Dahl during the spring of 2010 in Paris, France. On that fateful day, my husband Mark and I had just retired to our hotel, where I, of all things, lent into writing a post for my new blog, Ward Gossip. I felt slightly silly. Back then, Ward Gossip had a readership of about 4. Nevertheless, I think it's maybe tripled since then. Nevertheless, as the lovely Parisian breeze wafted through my window, I hammered out yet another post. It was a satirical piece about how one might enjoy the city of light through the protective lens of the LDS Church. My fantasy tour included a genuine Parisian review performed by local Miamis, and a whirlwind bus tour conducted by a church member who used the famous glass pyramid outside the Louvre as a segue into a plug for his latest business venture. Confident that I had satisfied my fan base, I settled down to a nap, later awakening to an astounding sight. 2, count them, 2 comments beneath my post. The second coming from my newest reader, a woman who called herself Insana D. Confident that I had said, Donna, she wrote, you have no idea how close you are to my mother and sister's visit to London. They were so excited to see a McDonald's nearby so they could find something to eat. What the LDS love to proclaim, that the church is the same everywhere, is a bit like a self-condemnation. It's like saying we are the McDonald's of religions. McMormon nuggets all lined up in pasty, fatty, white, deep-fried, overcooked, pressed meat alike and completely tasteless. McMormons. And so I was introduced to Dana Dahl's rapid-fire wit. Right then I knew that this was the beginning of a beautiful friendship. The poet Mary Oliver asked, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? My friend Dana could easily be the poster girl for that quote as she progressed from Mormon child to Mormon wife and mother to single mom and then to ex-Mormon. She never seemed to lose her joie de vivre, and found humor in even her darkest moments. For those of you who had the pleasure of hearing him this morning, she was and is what David Tweedy would call Jesse Jetsetter, always looking beyond the pile of poo to find the pony. I can't say I was ever a true believer, she told me recently, but I was there for the social interaction. If it was fun, daring, or just different, I was always ready to go. Dana Dahl began her performing career at the age of 2, or no, excuse me, in second grade. I'm sorry, Dana, not 2, in second grade, when she did cartwheels for the school parade on a day that she had forgotten to wear her panties. She graduated from North San Pete High School, where she excelled academically and took every opportunity to have fun. She served as her school's mascot, Spunky the Hawk, and upstaged the cheerleaders with her unintentionally hilarious dance moves. She appeared in the Manti Mormon miracle pageants, first as a Lamanite, her body coated in vegetable-based paint to make her skin appear appropriately cursed. Then later as a white and delightsome Nephite sacrifice who was impaled by a character resembling a witch doctor on Gilligan's Island. But the real fun came after the show, when she, along with her fellow fictional characters, washed off her body paint in the freezing water at Palisade Lake, and then later made out with her current beau to warm up. Speaking of beaus, Dana once dated Adam Swap, who took her to see Young Frankenstein, only to storm out of the theater because he was so appalled by the irreverence. Because the night was young and there was still fun to be had, Dana ditch-swapped, called up his best friend, and then went back to the movie with him, the two of them sitting through the feature twice. The next day at school, an indignant Swap slammed his books on Dana's desk and insisted, "You need to be more obedient." Apparently, that's not a good motivator for someone like me, Dana later confessed. After that, they parted ways. Swap became a polygamist and went to prison after an altercation with federal agents, a stint that landed him a segment on Inside Edition with Mari Povich. And Dana went on to other beaus, ones who managed to be better sports, as well as to void the lineup on America's Most Wanted. In college, she was a national champion and gold medal winner in persuasive speaking and after dinner speaking. She was a self-proclaimed mule for the LDS Church, doing any dirty job she was asked, including Warden Stake Homelinking Leader, Sunday School Teacher, Primary Counselor, Roadshow Director, Preparedness Director, former wife of a three-time Elders Quorum President who had a pickup truck and a refrigerator dolly, Nursery Leader, and as she puts it, other small-minded, time-consuming, petty nothings. She is a residential designer and draftsperson of over 400 custom and development home plans. I had the opportunity of seeing a couple dozen of these just this past Thursday. She is the owner, designer, builder, waterer, weeder, and general all-around slave of Red Hen Gardens, growing fine vegetables, flowers, greens, and noxious prickly weeds on a rocky acre in a little town that time forgot, New Harmony, home of John D. Lee. She is mother of three living children and two celestial children, grandmother of five, and a wife of a guy she describes as a really great, mild-mannered, left-a-liberal, hippie woodworker who can cuss better than anyone in the universe, especially if he gets a load of crappy lumber. By her own admission, she's volunteered too much, taken on too many stray dogs, fed a lot of homeless folks and wandering teenagers, and hosted more strangers than a cheap truck stop brothel. She is author of two blogs, Finding the Pony, and also Cora Hoare and Her Double D's, a site which I had the privilege of guest posting on a couple of times. Her Facebook wall is a daily source of entertainment and wisdom. Also, she's a talented artist who has designed, among other things, some pretty amazing book covers. And now it is my absolute pleasure to introduce my wild and precious friend, Dana Dahl, also known as Insana D.
Thank you, Donna. You make me sound almost legitimate. I'm going to move this out here. I'm short. There's too close.
You sound like Sue Emmett.
Sue Emmett? I have a fairly loud stage voice anyway, so I'm going to be moving around. I'm hoping to be a little bit animated, and I'm really hoping I can help you kind of wet your pants tonight. Thank you very much, Donna, for that wonderful introduction. You really do me well. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the Ex-Mormon Foundation. I'm so honored to come here and present tonight. A mere 6 years ago, I came to my first conference scared and worried that my family would find out and have me tarred and feathered at the family compound in Washington, or at best, hang me in effigy. But now look at me. I'm out loud and proud, as proud to be an ex-Mormon as John Elton John. Elton John! As Elton John at a gay pride festival. I'm getting a little scared. As if anyone ever questioned that we weren't born this way. I like to call myself an emancipated Mormon, not just because of the freedom that it alludes to, but because it kind of pisses off the Mormons when you suggest that there was something that was so oppressive that you needed to be freed from. Some of you may know me online as Insana D or Dolly Mama on Postmo. I think I've posted probably well over 10,000 posts in past years, but I haven't been on either of those since Facebook kind of took over. My husband says that I'm on Facebook a bit much. I got the nickname of Insana D or Dana Insana in elementary school because I had a very bad temper. And if anybody couldn't defend themselves against the bullies, I would tear in like a Tasmanian devil. I learned to cuss from my father, who could shoot out a string of cuss words like chips from a wood chipper. So I would tear in and start cussing and hitting and clawing and biting and kicking, cussing up a storm. And so they kind of got a little scared of me, and they called me, "Here comes Dana Insana." So Insanity has been a pretty good place to hide ever since then. I always maintained a kind of a posse of misfits and Odd Folks and The Goonies, and it turns out you all make some of the very best and most loyal friends. My dear husband, Bill, will you stand up? Bab is... He's with me here tonight. His real name is William or Bill, but I gave him the nickname of Bab shortly after we met. We met under somewhat scandalous circumstances, something I tend to draw around me everywhere I go. I gave him every warning and chance to just run out the door and never look back. But for some reason, he's kind of a glutton for punishment, and he thought I was worth the trouble. So after we'd been together for a while, and I'd confessed all of my dark sins to him, or some of them, there's a few. Good one. He's a pretty mild-mannered guy and not prone to taking big risks. He's a little bit anal retentive as a woodworker, and he likes to balance the checkbook every single day and hear that ka-ching on his Quicken program. So to marry a woman like me was a pretty big risk. And when I asked him to be with me, he just sucked it up and made that huge leap across the chasm of fear that he must have been feeling. So I nicknamed him Badass Brave Bill. So, Bab. You're all here tonight for some of the same reasons that I came several years ago, to find a community of friends and people that understand and sympathize and help you through the process of your own emancipation. I know how scary it is, and I definitely know the price that many of us pay. You're not alone in your suffering of loss of family and contact with your grandchildren. It's something many of us can talk about. But I'm not here to talk about the hard things tonight. I feel your frustrations and struggles. I know that you guys are all badass, brave ex-Mormons. I'm going to call you Babe. Not because you're just all badass, but because I probably won't remember your names. I'm terrible. And by the way, before I forget, PR and her wife, Holly, which is the same name as my daughter, she did my hair and then I messed it up. But I really appreciate her coming in at the last minute and bringing some scissors and making me look like I came out of almost the 20th century. My daughters all think that I am stuck in the 80s, and I think I am too, because that was my Olivia Newton-John phase, and that's when I thought I looked the best. It's my cover to call you Babe, but it's okay to be scared. It's okay to feel a little bit anxious and intimidated by the process. It's okay to ask questions and not be satisfied with the answers. It's okay to read books. It's okay to watch the internet. It's okay to listen to the music you want or get the tattoo you want. It's okay to wear the clothes you want and drink the drinks you want. We're full-grown adults, and we can say what we want to say. Some may ask why I choose to poke fun at Mormonism. Well, the easy answer is because they kind of make it really easy. Really, this stuff kind of writes itself. And one week of headlines of LDS shenanigans, and I have a whole month of blogs. In fact, I think Donna wrote one about the recent, was it Ballard that said, you can talk, but don't talk too much, at a women's conference in Europe. And it was a women's conference where only men were allowed to speak. And didn't we all practice those same things and teach those silly things and walk in line and enforce those trite little petty rules? Didn't we give simple answers to complex questions? Weren't we one of them? We marched in line to those silly leaders. We bowed our heads. We prayed and we paid and we obeyed. Maybe it's healthy to just laugh at ourselves. We're not that far off from what we used to be. We're not far off from the true believers. Some of us may just be newly out of the Mormon nursery, taking your first sip of dangerous wine cooler for the very first time. Some of you may be having fun sex for the first time in your life. Some may be reading a book that isn't explicitly banned, but it definitely raises some questions that the church would rather you didn't ask. And some of you may be jaded and rode hard and put away wet like me, and already kind of weathered in this storm of ex-Mormonism, and you've read a lot, and you've spoken a lot, and you've written a lot, and you're kind of processed out. I call my brand of humor self-defecating. I hope I can help you mess your own pants tonight as we laugh and process our own silly foibles. Being a Mormon was hilarious. It was preposterous. It was absolutely ridiculous what we believed. And we can look back now and go, oh, briminy, this was insane. I bought into that. I taught that. I made my children swallow that. Raise your hand if you grew up in the church in the 60s or 70s. Well, quite a few of you. You know, in my mind, that was the ideal, that was the golden years of Mormonism. It was before the internet, so we kind of went by ignorance back then and obedience. We had MM and Gleaners, fundraising, church house parties, payday dinners, road shows, all kinds of fun stuff. But then when we look back on it, we realize that that was also a time when there was great sexism, horrific racism, torture of gays, and many other things that bring shame onto the church. Sometimes those things don't just haunt the LDS church, but they define the LDS church. But we had David O. McKay, the kind of the Colonel Sanders of Mormonism. We had enormous growth in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and many families joined the church because they thought it was a great place to raise their children. Believe it or not, Sue, I was raised in Oregon, right near you in Sandy, just down the mountain from Mount Hood, until I was 12, and we were in a tiny little branch in Sandy, Oregon, and we loved it, and it was close, and it was enveloping, and it was the place my family went to avoid getting beaten out of our britches by my dad. So church was the place where we were happiest. Mormonism can create some pretty silly hang-ups and misconceptions in a little girl, and mixed with the backward oppressiveness of small Utah towns where I moved when I was about 12, and some of the inbreeding of the ideas, then you have yourself a perfect storm for a really messed up young woman. I was not terribly domestic, so I couldn't learn how to fold napkins properly, or how to knit, or how to do all of the little things that they tried to do to make me into a proper young woman. I was jealous of my brother's scouting adventures and all the money that they spent on the scout stuff and all the cool tools and the gear and the adventures and the trips that they got. And I was jealous of the money the church spent on it too, because us girls, when I wanted to join Girl Scouts, we weren't allowed to because it was an inappropriate place for girls to learn how to be young mothers and wives. I remember reading my brother's Boys Life magazine, and I was kind of lusting after some of these cute boys in the magazine. My mom had decided when my sisters and I were young that we would not grow up to marry a bad boy like she had done. So she wouldn't even let us go to our maturation program. We weren't to learn anything about our own bodies. In fact, I remember her just saying, just swipe it quickly with a washcloth and never touch it again. We weren't allowed to learn anything about boys, and so we kind of had to learn from the things around us. And I promise you, if you're not going to tell your kids about sex, they're going to figure it out in ways that probably aren't that appropriate. I learned about sex from farm animals. And let me tell you, a horse and horse parts can be very intimidating to a 10-year-old girl. When she learns that that part is supposed to someday be part of her. My mom always called it a kickstand. And so When I was a little girl, I thought it always kind of pointed down like a bicycle kickstand. But when I got into high school, I found out that it points up all the time. I'd seen bunnies do it. The doe just kind of munches some clover, and she looks around behind her and wonders what's going on and why her back fur's all sticky. And the poor buck, he just runs off to the next doe and the next doe and the next doe. I'd seen dogs do it, and I think the female dogs are not into it at all, except maybe just for the puppies, kind of like BYU brides. I'd seen cows do it, and let me tell you, nothing is inspirational about the way cows do it. Do you remember doing baptisms for the dead? Did you guys do that? When we were young, we turned 12, we looked forward to it because we thought that was such a spiritual experience. And then we got down there to the Manti Temple, and the basement of that Manti Temple where they had the baptismal font was bitter cold and damp all the time. Well, the outfits that they had for us were made from this thick cotton. And they were one piece, one size fits all, because, of course, you know, all 12-year-olds are the same size, right? Well, it was made so that if you were tall, it cut you in the shoulder and up in the crotch. So the poor tall girls looked like they always had a camel toe. The boys looked like they'd stuffed a wad of chicken fat in their underpants. And for short girls like me, it just kind of hung down between our knees, and we looked like something out of a funhouse mirror. No matter what we did to try to look elegant and modest in those awful contraptions, they would find a way to humiliate even the most beautiful of bodies. When they got wet and see-through, the girls had the choice to cover their nips or their pubic region as they took one hand to reach the priesthood member as they stepped out of that pool. No matter what we did, it was humiliating and slippery. My family was poor, so my mother made us our underpants out of gold medal flour sacks. And that's when the deacons found out that my butt was self-rising. I was so mortified that I decided the next time I wasn't going to wear any. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is why they rewrite those modesty policies every year. We were told that the souls that we were being baptized for would thank us up in heaven, and that we needed to memorize their names so that we would recognize them when we reached the pearly gates. I learned fairly quickly that there are only so many Maria Sanchez's and Jose Garcias to go around. And since they recycle those names over and over again for the kids, I found that if I just memorized them once, I was covered for the rest of the baptisms. A few years ago, several of my ex-Mormon friends were resigning from the church over the Prop 8 issue. And I had already resigned, so I decided I would start a new trend, necro-resignation, for and in behalf of any celebrity who is already dead. Since the Mormons like to posthumously baptize people who may or may not have ever wanted to be Mormon, I figured there was nothing stopping us from necro-resigning on their membership, also posthumously. In fact, I even had a dream, like Wilford Woodruff. I dreamt that Benjamin Franklin and the Founding Fathers came to me in a dream, and they said, "Hey, Dana, Mormon heaven is so boring, they don't even have rum. Could you get us out of here and back to the celestial kingdom where we belong?" So I resigned for and in behalf of the Founding Fathers. And while I was on a roll, I necro-resigned for the cast of Wizard of Oz, John Denver, Princess Diana, Gandhi, John Lennon, and several other folks I figured had no business being in a Mormon heaven. It's easy. You just look up the last known location of said celebrity, and their official birth date and their name, and you send in a resignation letter, I kind of get a little bit of a charge out of imagining some poor schmuck bishop and his counselors going to the forest lawn in Los Angeles and giving out a pamphlet to somebody's headstone. I had an idea for a really great musical, kind of to come after the Book of Mormon musical. We could have a musical called Hot Tub Time Machine. There's a time-traveling baptismal font, complete with the oxen and a couple of stoned missionaries like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. They have to go to the terrestrial kingdom and pick up the famous folks who have had their baptisms done posthumously, and that's where the hijinks start. They pick up Hitler and then Anne Frank, and that's when the sparks kind of fly. Then they pick up Marilyn Monroe and John F. Kennedy, and there's some kind of salacious innuendos and maybe a hot number by Marilyn with her bodacious tatas. Then maybe they get Elvis and Judy Garland, or maybe Christopher Hitchens and one of the dead popes, and they get into it. They get into an existential argument. They start duking it out, and Gandhi and John Lennon try to make peace. And Jeffrey Dahmer's there trying to eat everybody. They're all a little pissed that they were just having a really good time in the telestial kingdom and are now being whisked away to the celestial kingdom where they have to have eternal family home evening forever and ever. Don't you think that'd be a great premise for a musical? I went to my young women's activities and I tried to feign interest and obedience, but I was too interested in boys. I was too interested in science. I'd learned to read when I was 5, and I was reading books, hundreds and hundreds of books all through my childhood. I was too interested in comedy. I used to sneak down and watch Saturday Night Live with the audio down really, really low, but my mom could tell I was laughing because I laugh like a braying donkey. Ha, ha, ha! I wasn't very good at being a girl, and I remember one time in a Sunday school class, a high priest age teacher was substituting, and I don't remember the lesson, but it was probably something on the Bible, and I asked one too many logical questions. Finally, he slammed his book down on the table, and his face was all red, and his veins were bursting, and he slammed his book down, and he said, "You are a girl." Well, that was absolutely true. Just the awareness of that in an LDS setting sets a girl up for a lot of complicated things. It didn't take long for me to realize that I was not celestial glory material. I figured I was probably hellbound. And you know, it kind of frees you up to just go and have a good time when you know you're not going to make the cut. In fact, I highly recommend give up being perfect. That "be ye therefore perfect" has caused more suicide and depression than almost any other principle in the church. Go and have a good time. Be human, be flawed, be fat, be bald, be gay, be lesbian, be short, be anything you want, but just be yourself. I was kind of a late bloomer, and I didn't get my boobies till I was almost 15. The summer before my sophomore year, I was getting pretty discouraged and kind of worried that they were never going to show up. My Irish twin sister had gotten hers at 12, and so I was pretty worried. So I decided I was going to stuff my bra. We couldn't afford 2-ply, and it takes an awful lot of 1-ply to get a convincing mound. So I rolled it up and I stuffed it in, and I was pretty convinced I had a convincing rack, and I headed off to MIA. We were learning to do the hustle. My dance moves kind of resemble either the robot from Lost in Space. That does not compute. Or maybe a tub washer with one leg off kilter and the hoses are flying. Well, no matter what, somebody's bound to get hurt, and I've got my arms jutting out, and somebody's getting hit in the neck while I'm going left while they're going right. Well, that's when the one ply decided to manifest itself through the bottom of my shirt. And some dumb boy decided to pull on it and reel me in on a one ply line of shame. The embarrassment was so much, my face was so red, I ran from the meeting and ran home. Well, that must have kick-started things, because within a couple of weeks, Anno and Tano arrived. It was like watching one of those magic sponges when you put it in a bowl of water. I'd wake up every morning surprised at how much bigger and more bodacious my tatas were. I entered my sophomore year, and I was so proud, and I almost looked like a girl. I thought about all the joshing I'd received for having such a flat chest, and I thought, I'll show them! Well, I was no more going to be called the pirate's treasure or Chet's effeminate little brother. I was a girl. I was just itching to try out all my new parts and sundries, and I managed to find a couple of the homeliest and most awkward boys in the county to oblige. I managed to stay just shy of losing my virginity, not because of any careful protection on my part, but mostly just lack of opportunity. As my siblings and friends and cousins got married, I developed a kind of a business plan in my head for LDS wedding receptions. I'm sure most of you have been to one of these or had one, maybe even yourself. You know, the nut cup, 7-Up, plop of sherbet, sheet cake, and the whole ward gets in a line and shakes your hand as they pass through and hands you a gift that was regifted from their own wedding. Some of these receptions are so sad that I kind of feel sorry for the bride. But given that the Salt Lake City Temple brags that they do over 650 weddings a day, I think the theme of factory-farmed receptions kind of has merit. So here's my business planner scheme. We could franchise these throughout the Morador. We could get in on the ground floor. We could have an MLM of wedding receptions. The starter kit comes with a green screen and maybe a plastic lattice in an arch with some dusty old plastic flowers and some ribbons to tie to the basketball hoop. The price starts at $300. The bride and groom can choose which temple they want projected on that green screen behind them. The guests file in. There's a card reader where they can select a gift for $20 or up to $100 or a small appliance or bedding. And then they get on a people mover conveyor belt and they gently glide in front of the wedding entourage and shake their hands. And at the end of the people mover is another drink dispenser with a nut cup and 7-Up, and they get a nut cup, 7-Up, and a plop of sherbet, and they're on their way. It moves along well enough that the whole reception could be done in about an hour, and the bride and groom could go off to the Motel 6 and kind of get down to business. They could handle 3 wedding receptions a night in any stake center or ward building. If the couple's on a really tight budget, they could opt for the $50 plan, just stand in front of the Relief Society room, and a sweet sister could stand at the other door and just chuck a cupcake and a glass of water at the passing guests. For less than the cost of a set of tires, you could marry your precious daughter off to some returned missionary, not have to break the bank. Call insanity for all your cheap-ass LDS wedding reception plans. There's bulk pricing if you have more than 2 daughters. I went through LDS seminary like many of you, and I studied scriptures, I learned my lines, I played along and bore my testimony when I was told to. Without having much to compare the Book of Mormon to, I bought into it, but I've since found that many of the claims are just outrageous. They're preposterous and silly. In all of the hundreds of books that I've read, and I have read hundreds, even though my husband doesn't see it, the Book of Mormon is the slowest, the most tedious, the hardest to slog through. No wonder Mark Twain compared it to chloroform in print. The LDS like to boast that Joseph Smith was not the author of the Book of Mormon, but just the translator. It turns out that fabricating scripture is just a piece of cake, especially if you don't have to produce the original for any kind of scrutiny. It's fun, and it's a pretty simplistic diversion, and anyone can master it if they remember to put in a lot of yay verilies and it came to pass instead of a regular transition. Just a few years ago, in kind of a fit of stupor on post-Mormon, I wrote these companion scriptures to the accounts of the horses and chariots in the Book of Mormon. And they're as legit and plausible as and a darn sight funnier. Can I have one person from each table come up? We're going to do a scripture reading. I think this would be fun. I need a total of 15 people. We're going to play a game. It's called Reformed Egyptian or Reformed Insanity. Okay. We need... Can we get some more ladies?
That's all me.
Ladies? Hello? Welcome to the priesthood.
Yes.
We want to hear your voices, just not too much.
Yeah.
Do I have to be?
I don't know where
I don't
you
know
have
where.
To be.
Yes.
I guess you have to be over there.
You have to be over there.
You should know your place, sister.
Yeah. Okay. All right, I'm going to put 12 through 15 right back through here, so you get to read two.
All right.
Unless we have some more people. Okay. All right, folks. You get to guess whether this is Reformed Egyptian or Reformed Insanity. Can we start with number one?
Number one. Their land also is full of silver and gold, neither is there any end of their treasures. Their land is also full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots.
Reformed Egyptian or Reformed Insanity? Nope, Egyptian.
Yea, verily, the horses of the land beareth likeness unto the squat pig, even unto the tapir, but said that right. But for the purposes of these holy scriptures, we shall call them horses, even though they don't look anything like horses and are... and are short, belligerent, and nigh untrainable in the arts of horses. But we shall hereafter call them horses.
Insanity!
And they said unto him, Behold, he is feeding thy horses. Now the king had commanded his servants, previous to the time of the watering of their flocks, that they should prepare his horses and chariots, and conduct him forth to the land of Nephi. For there had been a great feast appointed at the land of Nephi, but the father of Lamoni, who was the king over all the land...
Insanity or Reformed Egyptian? Okay.
I would think so. For yea, verily, and lo and beholdeth, Lamoni, the dark and loathsome dark king who had clearly been unrighteous in the preexistence and was therefore relegated to the lowly birth of dark and loathsome in this life until he could prove his worthiness to become white and delightsome, as is promised, anyway... Yea, verily, he clapped his dark and loathsome hands in and an abundance of servants who were even darker and more loathsome rallied. Yea, verily, and brought him his horses and chariots.
So what say you? But I'm pretty close. Okay.
But notwithstanding that there were no horses, but only fat, ugly, obnoxious tapirs, and no evidence of wheels, but his chariots were more like fanciful sleds, the dark and loathsome servants did bring forth some tapirs, with a fancy sled. And King Lamoni did command the tapirs to go forth upon the land, and they lunged and eventually drugged the king, the lardy king, through the mud and feces throughout the land on his sled. And he waved his dark and loathsome hands and blessed his filthy Lamanite hordes.
There's an elder that once said in a, I think it was maybe 2006, he stood up in some kind of a conference meeting, and he said how proud he was that the Mormon Church had always stood against racism in all its malignant forms.
Now when King Lamoni heard that Ammon was preparing his horses and his chariots, he was more astonished because his servants were determined to wrestle those unruly tapirs into harnesses and other paraphernalia and pull the sled/chariot that lacked wheels, and he was astonished at the absurdity of it all. Because of the faithfulness of Ammon, saying, "Surely there has not been any servant among all my servants that has been so faithful as this man, for even he doth remember all my commandments to execute them."
Which one? It's both. I move the goalposts. That's a true scripture writer.
For yea, verily, even unto Big Whoop did the King Lamoni, who was getting whiter as I scratched this into the brass and gold plates, did saith to Ammon, "You're sure that's a horse? Looks like a damn taper to me. But what do you know? I'm a dark and loathsome Lamanite, so if you're going to say it's a horse, I got to believe you. Thanks for fetching my chariot sled. You're a good'un, Ammon. Yep, a right good'un."
And it came to pass that when Ammon had made ready the horses and the chariots for the king and his servants, he went in unto the king and saw that the countenance of the king was changed. Therefore, he was about to return out of his presence.
Yea, Ammon was pretty dang impressed, but he was also the type that could be easily duped because he thought a taper was a horse and a sled was a chariot. Yea, Ammon was sort of a fool, thus verily.
Now, when Lamoni had heard this, he caused that his servants should make ready his horses and his chariots. Yea, verily, this has been established. But since I, Joseph, the servant and savant of the Lord, am commanded to keep writing as if I have something to say, do filleth page after page with pure codswallop, yea, verily, absolute bullshitteth. Because it maketh me seem important and filleth pages.
Kind of like our seventh grade reports.
And it came to pass in the 17th year, in the latter end of the year, the proclamation of Laconius had gone forth throughout all the face of the land, and they had taken their horses and their chariots and their cattle and all their flocks and their herds and their grain and all their substance, and they did march forth by the thousands and by the tens of thousands until they had gone forth to the place which they had been appointed that they should gather themselves together to defend themselves against their enemies.
So? Egyptian. Now imagine scratching this word by word by word by overprocessed word by word by word by word by word by word, yea, verily, by word by word by word into brass or gold plates.
Now, in the firsteth months of the beginning of the year, most likely unto the 18th year, did Laconius and his thousands of followers and warriors and harlots and various support staff and all the warmongering generals and map makers and weapon pounders and more harlots and some cooks and, oh, a few of these bean counter types that don't carry guns but are good at the details, and some more harlots did gather together for a great war.
I'm pretty sure that's Egyptian because it has guns and other acronyms.
tape bearers and sleds, hereafter known as horses and chariots, did line up for a large battle, yea, verily, epic and bloody, which delighteth my servant Joseph Smith. Who likes such bloody stories and grand illusions of victory of imagined enemies and virgin, young virgins?
Yes. And wives.
Yea, verily, the tapers did shite themselves in the face of the enemy, and the stench of their excrement did penetrate the nostrileth region of the warriors, causing them to retreat and go to the harlots for comfort. Thus the war was put off for a few days because some generals did pulleth a hamstring in their vigorous harloting.
I'm pretty sure that's Joseph.
Yea, woe be unto the Gentiles except they repent. For it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Father, that I will cut off thy horses out of thy midst, out of the midst of thee, and I will destroy thy chariots.
Reformed Egyptian or insanity? That's actually a true Reformed Egyptian one. And now I will close this. Thank you very much, folks.
Dorothy's back?
No, we're good. And now I'll seal up those the unsealed portion with this. And let this be a lesson to ye freaking Gentiles. For it did come to pass that the Father cut off thy horses and destroyed thy chariots, even unto lifting every evidence from the face of the earth, and its bowels and its secret parts. And he did evaporate all the metal and the swords and the implements of war. And he did make the blood of Tonto the Jew to match, to be identical to the Asiatic people. And behold, the Lord did confound all the evidence of the ancient Jews on the Americas, and he removed all likeness of truth, for the Lord did feel generally pissed off and pretty damn revengeful, which was like him considering his past shenanigans. And the Lord went off to sulk and plan his next catastrophe. Adieu and adieu. Saith the Lord, because he had just been to Canada and he thought it sounded real fancy. I met my ex when I was in my second year of college, and when I was on the rebound, I was engaged to a man that is related to royalty, and I won't say who, but it rhymes with Moid K. Schmacker. Within a few months of being with my ex-husband, I got pregnant. He wasn't my ex-husband yet then. I planned on it later. We waited the standard year of shame like many do, and then we went to the temple and had our infant son sealed. Back then, the Manti Temple was being remodeled, and so we had conceded to that hideous Provo Temple that looks like a sheet cake with a candle stuck in it. This was back in 1983 when they still did the naked, creepy touching and the death slashing. I didn't know about any of that when I went the first time. So when it was quite a shock when I did the washing and anointing and that sweet old lady tried to touch my ano and tano and my nether regions with her damp, cold hand. If that wasn't humiliating enough, I got to the next part of the hazing, where they tried to give me a new name. Are there any Nimrods here? I try to imagine the old coots as they're sitting around trying to pick the names that get recycled every couple of weeks in the temple. And I just can't imagine any era in time when Nimrod was cool. I'd never heard of that part of the ceremony either, in spite of having been to the temple prep classes. So I was sort of irritated and already livid from the naked touching. So when they gave me the name of Judith, I was upset. I was in rebellion mode, which doesn't take much for me. The only Judiths I'd known up to that point were bitches. They were loud and obnoxious and outspoken, not calm and sweet and demure like me. I didn't want to spend eternity as a Judith. My whole family and my dear aunties and uncles were up in the endowment session waiting for us, so my mother hustled me up, and I sat there just trying to process what had happened to me. I remember as they started that Pele Ale, Pele Ale, Pele Ale group prayer, that I looked around me, just sure that it was an elaborate hoax, and that Alan Funt was going to come out from behind the curtain and say, "You're on But no, it was real. And it was then that I realized I was deep in the colon of an oppressive cult. I wanted out, and I wanted out bad, but the pressures from my family and the moment just kind of propelled me forward, a little bit zombie-like, but I was still agitated enough to be aware of what was happening. Then it got worse. I sat there seething about what I'd been just done and been asked to agree to. You're kind of tricked into it. And then it came time for the veil room. When I got to the nylon curtain and that doddering old coot pulled me in for the 5 points of shell fellowship, it's kind of a hug and grind thing, I was in FU mode. He asked me to reveal the new name, and I stammered for a minute, and then I lied. I said, "Ruth, the sweet, demure woman from the Bible." I lied in the temple, and I said, "Ruth," and he kind of checked his chart, and he stammered for a minute, and then thinking maybe it was some kind of a revelation from God, he told my ex to pass me through under the name of Ruth. To this day, he still thinks I'm Ruth. When he calls me forth from the first resurrection, I'll be a Ruth, and he'll say, "Ruth, Ruth," but I'll be a Judith, the bitch from the Apocrypha. All those formative years in the church kind of set me up for a lot of hard questions and frustrating situations, and I was bored out of my brain. I started seeing that going to church is a lot like living on Gilligan's Island. At first, the plot is kind of fun and kitschy, but pretty soon it becomes boring, and the characters start to make it so predictable and dull that even the most addle-brained, obedient Mormon is just running on autopilot. I was no ginger, and since I don't really like to bake, because following a recipe makes me feel oppressed, I didn't even make a very good Marianne. In fact, I was most like Gilligan. I was always getting into trouble. I was always curious. I was always pushing the red button. Curiosity has led many people into danger, as well as discovery. And like many of you, I started asking some of the harder questions when I was fairly young and I got nowhere. In fact, when I'd ask, I was often told that since I was a mere woman, that I would have to leave the heavy lifting up to the men. Since I couldn't find answers within the church, I started to look elsewhere. And it didn't take too much digging to find that what I'd been told didn't add up to the scientific information or studies or other historical documentation. I really think that the Mormon.org was created by a mole inside that wants to just make it so tedious and hard to find an answer that everybody has to go to Google. In fact, with the internet and the abundance of information available now, a literate 10-year-old could undo the church in an hour. By the time I was in my mid-30s, I was struggling with my marriage and the church, and I decided to escape both at the same time, something I don't recommend unless you like falling flat on your face and getting no help from anyone. I'm going to invite my husband, Bab, up to read this poem. A friend of mine wrote this while he was going through his own divorce, and he had written this poem to express some of the frustrations that he felt, thinking that he was writing it privately. Well, to his ex-wife's prodding, his son was tracking him on the internet, and his stake president found out about this poem, and he was invited to resign his membership. He gave me permission to use the poem, but I won't use his name. You ready, sweetie? Mormonism tastes like spam. Frankly, I don't give a damn whether it is testified, lightened, whitened, fixified. I do not like that Joseph Smith. I do not like the Mormon myth.
You will like it, you will see. Fill your bowels with charity. Read the scriptures every day. Fast, pay tithing, always pray. Then you cannot help but know a still small voice will tell you so.
God must not have heard my prayer, or if he did, he didn't care. I didn't hear him on my knees. I didn't feel him in the breeze. In darkest nights, no inner lights, no rescues by the three Nephites. I could not trust that Joseph Smith. I would not buy the Mormon myth. They told me that I never tried. God's non-response was justified. I wasn't pure, I wasn't good, I didn't do the things I should. If I were worthy, then I'd see the Holy Ghost would comfort me.
God loves the soul who contemplates, unless, of course, he masturbates, or puts weird colors in his hair, or balks at holy underwear, or kids, or fibs, or laughs too loud, or sometimes wants to join the crowd, or girls who show their midriff skin and cause Aaronic priesthood sin. Sometimes God gets kind of pissy at the independent missy who speaks her mind and doesn't find a testimony meeting blissy. God loves meek. He loves the mild, the ones who trust just like a child and give their pennies, pay their tithes, let the prophets take their wives. God loves everyone, we're told, unless they will not fit the mold. Praise to Joseph in the grove, searching for the treasure trove. Put his face down in the hat. Who the hell came up with that? In the eerie searstone light, words come floating into sight. Nephite testimony bearers, quoting later King James errors. Disregard all other views. Sit your asses in the pews. Pray some, say some, pay some more. Claim to love the three-hour bore. Follow those who chat with God. Firmly grasp the iron rod.
What the flock? This isn't right. I prayed with all my heart and might. I repented fast and fasted slow, begging God to let me know. And finally, I've come around, standing back on solid ground. I do not like that Joseph Smith. I do not like the Mormon myth. I can't say that leaving the church was the cause of the end of my marriage, but the church certainly interfered in an already kind of sick and twisted marriage. One of those was the empty and uncreative intimate aspects. I'd kind of begun to believe that I didn't really enjoy sex. So when I got divorced, I decided to find out what it was all about. I was like a bowl in a candy shop. I was mini-skirted and trolloped up and trashy, ridiculous stuff that makes me cringe with embarrassment now. Many of us are going to go through a rum spring as we learn to leave the church. Many of us do idiotic things, but eventually we kind of find our center. Has anyone here ever tried online dating? Okay. Well, that's how I met my husband, Bab, so it's not all bad. But I kind of liken it to shopping at a really crowded thrift store. There's a lot of stained and ragged and smelly stuff. There's a lot of stuff with broken zippers. But if you search and search, once in a while you find something that's kind of classic, that's a little well-worn, and fits just right, and it's still stiff in all the right places. Thank you, Bab. One of the most memorable profiles came from a guy who apparently didn't like commas. He had 6'5" tall black hair and 168-pound brown eyes. I tried to imagine our first date, and we'd be walking along the beach, and he's pushing his eyeballs in a wheel. We gaze out at the sunset over the Great Salt Lake, because really, when you say you like long walks along the beach, that's the only beach for 700 miles. There's brine shrimp rotting at our feet and mosquitoes buzzing around his big eyeballs. He'd look up at me with those big brown pools of lustfulness, and then he'd nod his head at me, chopping me with his big 6'5" black pompadour. I'd dodge and pretend it was just a deer fly in the sawgrass behind us. But alas, I didn't respond to his wink. But ladies, I'll bet you he's still out there if you're looking. After a few years of very terrible experimentation, I saw Bab's profile on Match.com, and I thought, this guy seems like he'd swerve to miss a jackrabbit. I could be friends with him. Well, little did I know that in his many commutes at 60 miles per hour across the dirt roads in the desert of Nevada, he had clipped many a jackrabbit and killed them and masticated them under his tires and hardly gave a wink. But we fit in all the right places, and after some really hard choices, we had things in place to get married. We got married on the bridge over the Virgin River at Zion National Park on December 30th, 2006. Was that the right year, hon? I got it right. I am terrible at that. Sometimes I can't even remember how old I am. My mother and his mother and our kids were there and one of his friends. We rented all the rooms of a sweet little bed and breakfast and shared the cold winter night and shared our honeymoon suite and had Christmas presents and homemade dinner, and we just had a really wonderful time together. We'd already had our honeymoon. I can't think of any LDS temple that can even hold a candle to Zion National Park and the beauty that surrounds that place. My mother watched us carefully sign our marriage certificate to make sure it was all legit and legal. Later, she told me how sad it was that we love each other so much, but that we'll never be sealed in the temple for time and all eternity. You see, LDS women, we can be traded up, but we're never free agents. And since my atheist husband will never go to the celestial kingdom and we'll never go to the temple together, then I still belong to my ex, who thinks I'm a Ruth. And I'm a Judith, and I'm going to go to hell, and I'm going to raise hothouse tomatoes and make salsa. You guys can bring the chips and beer. If there's an afterlife, I'll take my chances. But for now, for this life, I'm going to be Dana Dahl, and I'm married to badass Brave Bill. We live in a little old house in a little old town that time forgot. We have chickens and dogs and a wood shop and a cat and an art bus. And we love our life so much that we're not in any hurry to die and find out if we were wrong. Many of us pay an awful price for leaving the church. Some of us are still paying that price with our extended families. Yet every week I hear of whole families getting out intact and able to keep things together. I'm thrilled for them, and I know that many before have had to suffer divorce, the loss of love, their home, their children, and their jobs if they dared leave. A decade ago, to admit that you were gay, that you might not believe the Book of Mormon to be true, or even had questions about the third version of the first vision, it meant a threat of excommunication or absolute loss of family connection. But now there's whole groups of cafeteria Mormons who are allowed to ask questions and challenge authority. Not the lady ones, no. We don't have the right parts. We don't have the right authority. We don't have the right tone. But all that's being challenged in ways that we never thought possible. Few of us will ever return to the LDS Church. Too much has been learned, too many secrets uncovered, too much corruption shown. We can find good things in our past. We can appreciate even the bad for how it taught us to respect and love integrity and intellectual honesty. The adage, there must be freedom in, or there must be opposition in all things, is exactly what has made the freedom that we now feel so thrilling. We know what it's like to have our thoughts and our choices and goals sequestered and preordained till we felt like we were on a treadmill of dutiful, blind obedience. Our free will was stolen from us. Life after Mormonism might start off really rocky. It's difficult, and eventually we will find our balance, and we get to go off in different directions, and we choose for ourselves. We process, we rant and rave, and we discuss, and we write 10,000 blog posts. But we're not on the straight and narrow anymore. We're not in a rut that was preordained. The path is broad. It's full of interesting diversions that we get to choose for ourselves. We're free to follow our hearts and minds. The bitterness can evolve into ambivalence and mirth at what we used to be and do and believe. The anger can become laughter, loud, light-minded laughter. I've found that if you really want to get back at the LDS Church, at the corrupt leaders, or even at family that's hurt you, the very best thing you can do is go have a good life. Prove them wrong. Live authentically and do the things that make you happy, even if it's just to piss them off. Thank you so much for letting me present to you tonight and entertain you. I hope your dreams do come true and that you all live up to the title of badass, brave ex-Mormons. Give yourselves a hand.